Hello, I'm Dr. Roger Steiner, director of the Gavin Herbert Eye Institute and professor and chair of ophthalmology at the University of California, Irvine. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the Medscape Ophthalmology Wrap-Up for the American Academy of Ophthalmology 2012. I'm joined today in Chicago by Dr. Stephen Lane, adjunct professor at the University of Minnesota, and Dr. Bonnie Henderson, who is assistant clinical professor at Harvard Medical School. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us. What we want to do this in this wrap-up is talk about the highlights of the meeting, and especially including some of the more exciting things that we've heard on the trade floor, heard in presentations and symposium, and in the evening festivities as well. That's where you often learn the most. So the first, I think, impression that we all said we've had is that there was a remarkably upbeat attitude and spirit of the meeting, really despite an economic pressure situation that would not necessarily justify the positive feelings. What are your thoughts about that? Bonnie?
Well, I absolutely agree. I do think that even with the economic downturn, because we're in medicine, it's a very different field in that we're fairly untouched from the economics, and that with the technology that's advancing in ophthalmology, we're very excited with all the new innovations in ophthalmology, and we're able to provide care even in better and more efficient ways, even with the economic downturn.
Sure hope so. Steve, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I would really agree with Bonnie, Roger. I think that you walk the exhibit floor, there's a certain buzz about things, and it's really not coming necessarily, you know, from the big companies that we're used to seeing innovation come from. We're seeing a lot of innovation from small, little startup companies that have really tremendous technology and tremendous potential, and these, I think, are the real exciting things that we're going to see. Ultimately, who knows? They may be bought up by some of the larger folks who have the big names in ophthalmology. But I think people are encouraged. I think our colleagues are encouraged that these technologies really have the potential to really help our patients get better results, and as a result, be able to live happier, more fulfilled lives. And that's exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly is.
And I do think that some of that happens because the physicians are seeing patients on a daily basis, and they come up with new innovative ideas regardless of what is happening outside of their office. So if they find a better way to deliver a service, so let's say they find a more efficient way to operate, or if they think of a different idea, they're able to pursue that and make advances, and they're very excited about the new changes.
So let's turn to one of those changes, which is this is the year of microincision glaucoma surgery, and particularly technology that is not just for the glaucoma specialist, but also for the general cataract surgeon. Comments? What do you think about MIGS?
I think, you know, MIGS is very exciting because I think it's a real combination of the different fields. So previously, cataract surgeons did cataract surgery and glaucoma surgeons did glaucoma surgery. But now it's really been a combination, similar to the changes of refractive surgery and cataract surgery. Now the two fields are colliding, and I do think that if we're able to offer different types of non-invasive and simple procedures that actually deliver results, then it's a very exciting change in the types of delivery of care systems that we can provide.
Steve?
You know, glaucoma has traditionally been a very frustrating condition to treat. Eye drops have sort of been the mainstay of treatment for so many patients for so many years, and there really hasn't been anything that necessarily cures glaucoma. The best thing you can sort of do is to continue to put it off. When SLT and other laser-type procedures came along, then you start to see a little bit of a shift of glaucoma from being basically a medically treated disease to one in which some surgical intervention was taking place in the part of lasers. But then again, the treatment responses were usually for a relatively short period of time. They still had to be supplemented with drops, and real surgical procedures were reserved for those time periods when the patient was sort of crashing down or as sort of an end stage type of procedure. What the minimally invasive glaucoma stents and so on give to us are essentially a very, as it says, minimally invasive procedure that really can be done by non-glaucoma specialists as part of a very routine procedure which many ophthalmologists perform, that being cataract surgery. and be very effective in its treatment. So we now have a real surgical procedure that gives better results and has a chance of reducing the number of medications that a patient is taking, which again is one of these sort of life-changing events for many of these people and allows them more freedom in their lives.
And you can kind of look down the road, and given that MIGS really, at the moment at least with current devices, works best for people with early glaucoma, if in fact it gets applied early, will it, by stabilizing pressure and reducing the problems of compliance, which certainly many studies have suggested that the only time the patient uses the drop regularly is the day before coming to the doctor's office. So, you know, can we in fact keep people at the early stage of glaucoma and not see progression? Because, as you know, that's been a frustrating issue in the management of glaucoma from the beginning. It's never really been solved.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the fact that this is a procedure that you can do in conjunction with a cataract surgery, so it's not a second procedure, it's not an additional procedure, that this is very nice for the patient because they really are undergoing one procedure and having the benefit of the vision improving with a cataract surgery and also lowering the pressure with the glaucoma procedure. Yeah,
absolutely. The other really nice thing, Raj, that you know, that we have the potential for is it seems, at least from some of the early data and some of the things that were presented here at the Academy, that more than one of these has a greater effect. And so either placed at the same time with multiple eye stents at the same time, or possibly something that you would come back to because it is such a minimally invasive procedure, secondarily to add a second or third stent, I think really adds to the potential for this and some of the and a lot of the excitement about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's going to be very, very exciting. Ike Ahmed, for example, presents data that looks pretty compelling for two and three shunts. And since the drainage channel is not a 360-degree channel anyway, it's pretty much quadrants. It mm-hmm. makes sense that as many as four stents may make a big difference. Mm-hmm. But that'll be interesting.
And I think one other thing that should be emphasized is that a lot of the worries about glaucoma surgery is the fear of hypotony. So with these types of minimally invasive procedures, the risk of hypotony is almost zero. So it really is great for the early glaucoma patients. And for cataract surgeons that really don't delve in very serious glaucoma procedures, this is a very safe and effective method of improving the pressure.
Yeah. So now, you know, one thing, shifting gears into the mainstay of cataract and IOLs, you know, certainly my impression was that, you know, we're really not seeing any new technology other than the ongoing interest in femto lasers for cataract surgery per se. The machines are pretty refined. We didn't see any new devices introduced. And intraocular lenses, again, there we know of a lot of things that are somewhere in the pipeline, but probably not coming out in the next year. So the one area in that there is some real ongoing interest in and real growth in is the toric IOLs for astigmatism. And you know, market scope shows steady growth in that portion of the segment. I think surgeons are getting more comfortable that they get good results with toric IOLs. But Steve, can you fill us in a little bit about some of the great interest, but also some confusion over the work of Doug Koch and the role of the posterior cornea and trying to understand why right now we're kind of good but not great?
Yeah, no, I think that's very important. Doug Koch really did some very important work, and while all of it wasn't necessarily original, we've sort of known about the posterior corneal curvature for a long time, and Doug was the first person to point out all of the various papers that go way back 15 years ago and more. That talk about posterior corneal curvature, he was really able to sort of synthesize things to give us a better idea and essentially has shown us that the posterior corneal curvature is very important in our determination of corneal astigmatism. And after all, when we talk about the use of toric lenses, we're really talking about the corneal curvature. And if we don't take into account these important posterior corneal curvature issues, we may under or overcorrect patients in terms of the amount of astigmatism that's present. And so Doug was able to come up with some very nice, you know, very common sense kinds of discussions that really led us to the belief that there is a posterior corneal curvature and the direction and the magnitude of that. Now, of course, that gets to be confusing, and without sort of going into all of the details of exactly what that means, the fact that he was able to introduce this concept, I think, will now be built into calculators and things that we'll use coming on down the line for the calculation of toricity. I think the doctors are finally starting to understand that, you know, we never prescribe a pair of glasses without the cylindrical component as part of that prescription. Why in the world would we want to do that when we do cataract surgery and not fully correct the amount of astigmatism? We do it for that. It's pretty easy to do. Why should we not do it for cataract surgery? And I think it's this kind of a conceptual idea that I think is starting to take hold and that physicians are really starting to grab onto. Mm-hmm.
And I think it answers a lot of questions. A lot of patients have residual refractive error, residual astigmatism after a toric implantation. And a lot of surgeons were wondering whether it was just a miscalculation of their corneal curvature, or they put in the wrong lens power, or they implanted it improperly. And now that Doug Koch is really focused on the posterior corneal amount, maybe some of that residual astigmatism is actually because they didn't take into account the posterior corneal astigmatism. So just in a brief kind of little summary of his, I guess his hypothesis, is that because the posterior corneal astigmatism is adding against the rule astigmatism, that if you have a patient with the rule astigmatism, then the against the rule astigmatism is going to counteract some of that. So you're going to hold off putting in a toric lens until you see a greater amount of anterior corneal astigmatism. So I think by hopefully getting a nomogram into place, you know, like Steve was saying, and building it into the toric calculator, then we can actually adjust the amount of toric power we're going to put in and have a much better outcome and have a patient that sees better without the aid of spectacles after cataract surgery.
So have you started adjusting your toric powers?
I have. You know, I don't have a great nomogram because I think Doug is still working on perfecting it. But I do know that if I'm in between two toric powers, so for instance, if I was trying to determine whether I'm going to put in a power that's less or a power that's more, and if I have a patient that has with the rule astigmatism, then I'm going to go with the lesser power. Conversely, if I have a patient that has against the rule anterior corneal astigmatism, I'm going to err on the side of a higher power toric lens. So in my hands, I found that if I'm really trying to waffle between the two powers, that has given me some guidelines. And I think that's been something that's fairly new, especially since his great innovators lecture at ASCRS this past spring.
It tells you which direction to waffle.
Exactly.
Steve, how do you
I agree. And I believe, again, Doug has done some great work, but the exact numbers are yet to be determined. And I think the common problem, as Bonnie correctly pointed out, is that, you know, I found myself being much too aggressive in correcting with the rule astigmatism in the past and never necessarily could, you know, determine why that was, and found myself just empirically, not based on the work that Doug did, but empirically decreasing that amount, but not really knowing why it was. Now at least I have a good explanation. And so essentially, you know, we're talking about probably about a half a diopter. And, of course, the other thing is that especially in younger, you know, cataract patients, they shift against the rule with age. And so you've got almost a dual effect going on. You've got the posterior corneal curvature that you have to keep into consideration, plus the fact as they age, they're going to shift against the rule. So it's still, I think, going to probably be an age-related nomogram somewhere down the line. Mm-hmm. But I tend to do exactly what Bonnie does, using a half a diopter as kind of my stable point in terms of making that determination. So a patient, for example, with a half a diopter of with the rule cylinder that I may have wanted to correct previously, I'll absolutely leave alone and put in a spherical lens, whereas I may end up going up a power on my toricity in an against the rule patient with the same sort of thing, maybe a half a diopter measured, but actually being probably going to be more like a diopter or more as the lens of choice. So I am using that, but you'd have to take into account, I think Bonnie's absolutely right. Unfortunately, none of our calculations, you know, fall right on the number zero, and we have to hedge one way or the other.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if we start getting to the sophistication level where we actually use a topographer. You know, some of them do measure posterior corneal curvature, and perhaps we should be starting to pay attention to that too. One thing for sure, though, is that it does at least seem, it has the appeal of explaining why the high power corrections, you know, if you take somebody from four diopters down to one, you look like a genius. But when you're down at the low end and you're dealing with one diopter correction and then you're off that much because of the posterior curvature, it starts being a real issue. Mm-hmm. So another related issue, I think, has been the increasing use, and I think now is starting to be a much more widespread acceptance of the value of intraoperative aberrometry. Mm-hmm. And there have been some ongoing developments with the WaveTech Aura, as well as a new device that is going to be coming available soon, the Clarity system. Steve, you've been a real guru of toric measurements and monitoring. So what are your thoughts about these systems?
Well, I think conceptually, Roger, that the idea of having a device on our microscope that we would use intraoperatively to help us determine an intraocular lens power makes great sense. If there's a better way that we can achieve emmetropia, and I think, you know, that's kind of the way that I plan on ending my career, is to try and, you know, fix and get patients to emmetropia. That's, I think, a goal that is certainly very important to me. And we can only do so much with theoretical formulas and measurements. We need better ways to actually come up with what the real power of the eye is. And while all of these new formulas and so on that have been developed and are being used are certainly terrific and continue to show improvement, there's nothing like being able to do a measurement right at the time that you need it, determine what that size is, if that's the right word, and be able to then go ahead and put that particular lens in that matches what we get. And I think aberrometry really is the future of how we're going to be doing cataract surgery to get the very best results. Granted, we're a ways away from doing that, but there's some really quite good data now that suggests that we can do a little bit better now with aberrometry than we've been able to do with the theoretical formulas coming in. And as a person who uses one of these on a fairly regular basis, I find myself fairly frequently changing the lens power based on aberrometry from what I had intended to use when I walked into the operating room. So I think the potential here is great. It's wonderful that we've got companies that are really looking at this and improving their offerings, because in both Clarity and WaveTech, they have changed their technology, and it continues to, again, make this incremental improvements. And I'm very happy to be involved in this, and I think it's an exciting area.
I think this is especially important because of all the corneal refractive procedures we're doing, and I think it's something like 5 million LASIKs are performed every year around the world, and all those patients at some point, if they're lucky enough to live long enough, they're going to need cataract surgery. And so until we have a great way to measure the actual need for the IOL power, so intraoperative aberrometry is a perfect use of this, I think because of that huge wave of patients that are coming through that are going to need cataract surgery, we really need technology like this to make sure that we really nail the outcomes. And also because of these special lenses, before when we had just one type of lens, it's a monofocal lens, we didn't think about astigmatism, and the patients accepted that they needed glasses after cataract surgery, we didn't really need all these types of fancy new technologies. However, now the patients are really, their expectations are high. They really expect to see perfectly after cataract surgery. They don't want to wear glasses for anything, really. They definitely don't want to wear them to drive. They barely wanted to read or see their computer. So I think that if we can offer them ways so that we can really get the postoperative refraction perfectly emmetropically, I think that really is the holy grail. We always joke about that, but I think that is true. I mean, it really would be nice to give the patients the freedom. So it's not just a vanity issue. It's really just a freedom issue of being able to do things without looking for glasses all the time.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree. We invested in the Wavefront aberrometers this past year, and we're all very confident with it for helping us with the basic power, and then in special situations, refractive being the obvious one, but the ultimate one, Sam Garg, my colleague at UC Irvine, had the ultimate in conundrums, a fellow who had actually had refractive surgery, then had corneal decompensation, had DSEC, so now he's got he's got this element in the backside that's completely throwing off. Not only are you dealing with front side problems, what was the sphere and cylinder power on the DSEC graft? And so he went into the OR with about a dozen lenses of different toricity and sphere, and then used the Aura to decide which lens to use, and pretty much nailed it. So
it was very,
very impressive. Impressive.
I mean, the patient, for example, Roger, that we all have in our practices are old penetrating keratoplasty patients. And these are folks who, you know, had a corneal transplant sometime in their youth, perhaps for keratoconus or some other reason, and have grown up having to wear contact lenses, rigid contact lenses, to correct relatively high degrees of astigmatism and relatively high spherical errors, and who then develop a cataract. And now with toric intraocular lenses, which we just got done talking about, and the use of aberrometry, the potential to be able to take that patient and get them out of glasses with a single operation, with a single lens implant, and get it right the first time, is a true game changer for that patient. It's exciting and it's fun, you know, to be able to take care of patients like that.
And we're actually, you know, with our personal, you know, our interest in the femto incisions, we have been able to get suture out, whether it's DALK or a penetrating graft, in under a year now. And once you get the sutures out, mm-hmm. then we'll deal with the lens problem. And, you know, a lot of them are getting the high power. You know, those are usually the people who have the most astigmatism, but it tends to be geometrically symmetrical and regular astigmatism. You can pretty much nail it. And we're getting almost everybody under one diopter now, and it's really amazing. And they are the happiest patients around. So just to shift slightly into a different version of imaging, which is the one thing walking around on the exhibit floor, as well as some of the talk that I've heard, are devices to let us use smartphones like the iPhone or the iPad. You can hang those off of a slit lamp and actually get a pretty reasonable photograph. It's not going to be quite as good as one of the dedicated units, but it's quite serviceable. And then there are a lot of apps that I'm seeing now. Now, Steve knows, my favorite one that I stumbled across was related to the toric IOLs. And I had a patient post-op where there was this issue about what position was the lens in, and I realized that I didn't have a single slit lamp that I could angle the beam that actually had a degree reading. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I realized, well, all I had to do is if I put the light beam on the axis of the toric IOL and then held up my iPhone with this, basically it's a level, it was called iHandy, mm-hmm. free app, twisted my phone to match up with the light beam, I knew down to a tenth of a degree
really?
Where that lens was. So it was really pretty cool. But there are ones for vision testing and almost related to refraction.
Right, yeah. It's true. And it is amazing that we're actually starting to use our phones to do some of our medical work. And I do think that, especially with the cameras that we can launch on the iPhone onto the slit lamp, it's really terrific, because if you see an issue or you see a lesion that you'd like to take a picture of, then you don't have to try to send them to a slit lamp photography unit.
But the tendency is then you don't do it.
Then
right?
you don't do
and
it.
You never do capture
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think it's terrific. It's really nice to have this new technology.
I'm guilty as charged, too. I mean, right before I saw an interesting patient who had this corneal issue that I didn't know what it was, and so it was simple. I took out my iPhone. I took a couple of pictures. I knew I'd always have my phone with me, and I could grab my colleagues all over the floor and say, "You ever seen anything that looks like this?" I mean, it's, you know, sure, I could have taken them back to the slit lamp camera and taken a picture, but then I'd have this thing that I'd have to sort of lug around. My phone is always with me, so I think that we're going to see more and more of that.
Yeah, definitely. Again, another subject, but Steve, you've been one of the thought leaders in the whole issue of the ocular surface, how it's impacting ocular performance, particularly with multifocal lenses, for example, and there's some new technology for the ocular surface. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, the ocular surface is one of those things that people have sort of pushed off to the side for many years. The sort of dry eye, itchy, more burny type patient is something that's always been one of those frustrations in our offices. Because, number one, there's so many of those folks who come in. And number two, our treatment regimens have been so dismal for these folks that we just sort of close our eyes and sort of shake our heads when we see their names on the schedule. But it's a very unhappy group of patients. And there's some really neat things that are out now and that will be coming available in the very near future that were discussed at this year's AAO. Starting with some of the new preparations for some of the drops. I think we're seeing a movement now in the sort of tear gel type of higher viscosity vehicles that are being used for some of our drugs, and whether they be steroids or antibiotics or NSAIDs, we're seeing a larger and larger number of these kinds of vehicles. We're seeing a larger and larger number of these drugs being in these type of vehicles that are much more friendly to the ocular surface. Especially some of the preservative-free glaucoma drops, again, are another sort of a way of protecting the ocular surface. MGD, meibomian gland disease, again, a real problem. And we see quite a bit in our cataract populations. You know, these are patients that we really need to maximize the ocular surface so that we have a better chance of hitting our targets and having happy patients with better vision. And so any true treatments for meibomian gland disease are really helpful. In this regard, Tear Science has come up with actually a mechanical way of doing essentially lid hygiene for patients that provides a source of heat on the underside of the eyelid and also provides a little bit of pressure on the eyelid to essentially reset the meibomian gland. And when our computer crashes, we, you know, shut it down and we reset our computer and it comes right back up. The idea really isn't too much different. We basically evacuate all of the glands with this device, and then it allows the gland to reset and start to work better again without the thick secretions. And so again, a really nice now treatment, in-office treatment, that probably lasts 6 to 9 months or even longer in many patients with a single treatment. And so many of these things that are that we've used and on a chronic basis and where, frankly, compliance has been pretty poor can be obviated by some of these things. So it's getting exciting. And then finally, you know, we're learning more and more about nutritional kinds of aspects. And, you know, to me, ketchup is a vitamin and so, you know, I'm just not a supplement kind of person in general, but I've really become an advocate for omega-3s, especially the ones that have triglycerides as part of the constituency of the omega-3 itself. And I think that these, in general, are something that can really help these patients with ocular surface disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was gonna emphasize the nutritional supplements. I think that's something that's really been emphasized over the last year. People thought that these supplements really maybe were just somewhat helpful, but not that beneficial. But I think the studies are really showing that the omega-3s, the flaxseed oil, they really do help. And so I think that besides the traditional lid scrubs and the warm compresses, some of the newer innovations towards the tear film and the anterior surface will probably be beneficial in more lubrication, more soothing, and increased vision.
It's hard to beat a vitamin that can help your meibomian glands, keep you from getting cataracts, help you with macular degeneration, and oh, by the way, you don't get a heart attack either.
Right, exactly.
You know?
And my arthritis is better too.
Finally, very, very quickly, collagen cross-linking has been an interest of the cornea group because of keratoconus and ectasia, but you know, now the Avedro especially has been pushing toward other applications. They've developed a way of local treatment so they can start to influence the topography, and they're going to be introducing most likely a topography-driven local cross-linking treatment over the next year for either both to center cones and help with the ectasias, but also probably influence even the outcome of astigmatic keratotomy. So, you know, that's kind of cool. And then, and also there's some talk that maybe this should be used routinely after LASIK as a way of stabilizing the cornea and perhaps even allowing more aggressive, higher levels of treatment. I don't know if either of you have lined up or interested in cross-linking studies?
Well, you know, I think that one of the frustrating things about being in the U.S. is that sometimes we're not able to have some of these treatments that our colleagues in Europe and South America have, and it's always very interesting when we go to meetings in other places and we hear the results of the cross-linking, and it's very exciting. You know, I do think that it has been found to really support the cornea and decrease the risk of ectasia. So, you know, I do think the applications are very broad, so it's not really just going to be for keratoconic patients, but I do think that preventing the ectasia with the LASIK surgery is very interesting. So I don't know if you have.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think that as a corneal specialist, I think we're just scratching the surface on what we're going to be doing with cross-linking in the future, both in terms of the, you know, mechanical application of how exactly we provide the treatment, but also what the indications are going to be for. Unfortunately, you know, to do all of these various studies takes a lot of time. And we're, by and large, having to depend on our European and Canadian colleagues and Asian colleagues who are using these on a regular basis to get the information. How are you doing it? And this sort of works into what you were talking about earlier, Roger, with the sort of after the academy hours of what happens over dinner or a drink in the bar, where we start to see you know, how are these things being used and what are you using them for? And really it works for that. And mm-hmm. and so it is a tremendously exciting, but at the same time frustrating type of process, because it's going to be a while till I think a lot of these applications are in the hands of the person who's not involved in the studies.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It is nice that we benefit from the experience of our colleagues, and they can tell us how long should we apply the, you know, the medication, epithelium on, epithelium off, and so they are actually working out some of the knocks for us, so we have to be grateful for our colleagues for going through some of the preliminary studies for us.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to thank both of you, Bonnie and mm-hmm. Steve, for taking time from your busy academy meeting to come and chat about your impressions of this very busy and very active meeting. I'd like to thank the audience also for joining us. So I'm Dr. Roger Steinert, and on behalf of Dr. Stephen Lane and Bonnie Henderson, thanks for joining us at Medscape Ophthalmology Insights.